Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we continue our special series on the U.S. Constitution, highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution in Their Own Words, a two-volume collection of materials intended to add to our understanding of the remarkable stories and ideas of America's founders. This week we focus on freedom of religion and the story of Charles Carroll. But first, Dan Roberts concludes his three-part A Moment in Time series on the Webster-Hayne debate in the U.S. Senate in 1830.
Their debate may have begun on the question of tariffs and the sale of cheap Western land, but Hayne and Webster really were debating the future of the Union.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
In January 1830, concerns of land and tariffs boiled over into an argument over the Constitution. On one side was Senator Robert Hayne of South Carolina. He believed that a state could cancel or nullify any federal law it thought was wrong. He was opposed by Daniel Webster. Webster graduated from Dartmouth, practiced law in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and in 1822 was elected to Congress from Boston. He was opposed to slavery, but like Henry Clay, was willing to compromise with the South in order to preserve the Union. Nullification, however, to Webster, was a dagger in the heart of the Constitution. Replying to Hayne, Webster gave one of the most powerful defenses of federal sovereignty ever uttered, and he closed with these words, "When my eyes shall behold for the last time the sun in heaven, may I not see him shining on the broken and dishonored fragments of a once glorious Union, on states dissevered, discordant, belligerent, on a land rent with civil feuds, or drenched, it may be, in fraternal blood? Let their last feeble and lingering glance rather behold the gorgeous ensign of the Republic, not a stripe erased or polluted, not a single star obscured, bearing for its motto that sentiment dear to every true American heart, liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable." Until the Civil War, the U.S. was a low-tariff country dominated by the alliance of low-tariff South and cheap land West. But Daniel Webster's happy vision of the Union would only be secured by a bloody Civil War. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, 3 months before the 1972 presidential election, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger met in the Oval Office to discuss when and how to get out of Vietnam. Despite a heavy bombing campaign during the spring and summer in North Vietnam, the president had concluded that U.S.-backed South Vietnam probably would not survive. "We also have to realize, Henry, that winning an election is terribly important," Nixon told his national security advisor. "It's terribly important this year, but can we have a viable foreign policy if a year from now or 2 years from now, North Vietnam gobbles up South Vietnam? That's the real question." The conversation, recorded by Nixon's voice-activated taping system, was released in August on the 30th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. Some historians consider it evidence that Nixon sacrificed American forces in his quest for a second term in office, keeping them engaged to ensure that the South Vietnamese government would not collapse before the election. Kissinger, however, said in an interview that those historians are focusing too much on an informal conversation that did not reflect Nixon's policies. Every once in a while, he got discouraged and said, "Chuck the whole thing." But that was never his policy, Kissinger recalled. And, as Columbus Day is this week, we should report that the bell that rang out from Christopher Columbus's flagship, the Santa Maria, when the explorer first spotted the shores of the Western Hemisphere in 1492, has been returned to Spain. The bell was found in 1994 inside a Spanish galleon off the coast of Portugal in Portuguese waters. A Spanish court ordered it returned to Spain, pending further court proceedings representing both countries' claims to the only known relic from Columbus's first voyage. This is Talking History. Thank you. With me this week, as we continue our series on the founders and the Constitution, is Dr. Stephen Klugowitz, Executive Director of Collegiate Network, a nonprofit foundation that provides financial and technical assistance to student editors and writers of independent publications, and former Director of Education Programs for the Bill of Rights Institute. Klugowitz is the author of the Essay on Freedom of Religion for the Founders and the Constitution series. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be here.
At the start of your essay, you write that the road to achieving full religious liberty in the United States was long and arduous, and you spend much of the rest of your time showing this to be true. So let's take the same approach and begin, as you do, with the myth of the Puritans, the myth being that they came to America in pursuit of religious freedom. Why is that a myth?
Well, the Puritans certainly came to America in pursuit of their religious freedom, but they had no desire to establish religious freedom for any other groups. Of course, Puritan comes from the word pure, and the Puritans were a group in England, originally within the Anglican Church, that thought the Anglican Church was corrupted, that it was covered with these vestiges of Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, and the Puritans practiced these dissenting beliefs, or tried to in England, and were persecuted and fled to America. So when they set up their commonwealth, they were also intolerant. They didn't want anyone who held different beliefs corrupting their pure commonwealth in Massachusetts Bay. Good example of the persecution that the Puritans engaged in was a 1647 law the colony passed that declared that all Roman Catholic priests were to be banished from the colony and any who returned executed. Now, there's no record of a Catholic priest actually being executed, but there were four Quakers who were put to death between 1659 and 1661.
Okay, so let's say the origins of religious freedom in America may have some problems, but nevertheless, you write that by 1787, we as a people are committed to the principle of religious toleration and to the idea of separation of church and state. That's a major change, and we should talk about how we got there. But first, define for us the word toleration, because we just switched from the term freedom to toleration. What's the difference?
Yes, there were several terms used in this era by Americans, and each had a different shade of meaning. Religious toleration is the term I use often and was often used at the time. Religious liberty, liberty of conscience, or the rights of conscience. I think the first term, religious toleration, suggests that a certain set of religious beliefs is to be preferred to others. To tolerate something means that you put up with something that you deem to be wrong. And, you know, this was the earliest view of quote-unquote religious freedom, that you would just tolerate something. One thing was right, one set of beliefs was right, maybe an established church, but you would tolerate, put up with these dissenting beliefs. Now, I think later on you get more talk, and certainly in America, of a broader sort of thing like religious liberty or liberty of conscience and the rights of conscience. But the terms can be used and were used interchangeably at the time.
But technically, we begin with toleration, and then we move toward freedom at some point.
Yes, I would say generally that's true.
Okay, so let's talk about the origins of either toleration or freedom of religion. Get us started with the European origins.
Well, the idea of a separation between church and state is really, at heart, a Christian idea. You can trace it back to Jesus himself, who declared that man should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. And this was developed by the great Christian thinkers. Augustine of Hippo talked about the city of God, the city of man. So you really had an idea of at least separation of church and state from the time of Christendom through the Middle Ages. But why we got to this era of toleration, it was really a practical matter. The Reformation takes place, of course, in the early 16th century, and the unity of Christendom is broken apart. And you have so many competing groups, one country containing Protestants, often of various varieties, and Catholics, and it really becomes a practical matter. Now, this is not to say that the early Protestant reformers were champions of religious freedom, quite to the contrary. If you look at somebody like John Calvin, who set up a very totalitarian state in Geneva, or, of course, Henry VIII, who set up the king as the head of the church, I mean, that is not separation of church and state. But it was the effect of the Reformation, not the reformers themselves, but the effect of splintering Christianity into these various groups that made it a necessity for people just to get along.
So it's more of a practical reaction than it is a theoretical position?
Yes, I think largely so. I mean, you had some kind of abortive attempts in Europe, the Edict of Nantes in 1598, which was later repealed by Louis XIV. But it was really not until you get to America that you really get religious freedom established on a lasting basis.
Okay, let's talk about America. What are some of the colonial precedents?
Well, of course, Rhode Island, the establishment of Rhode Island. Roger Williams lived in Massachusetts, but he was forced to flee the Puritan Commonwealth because of his dissenting religious views, and he set up Rhode Island and instituted toleration for all people. The colony became a refuge quickly for groups like the Quakers and the Baptists. You had Maryland, which was set up by the Calvert family, and here was a great example, unlike Williams, who, well, he had to flee, of course, so I guess you could say it's practical necessity, but he also had a real philosophical commitment to religious liberty. Calverts in Maryland are Catholic and certainly want a place where they can go and not be persecuted, but they established toleration really to lure Protestants, knowing that most of the people who are going to come are going to be Protestant, and if you want people to come, most of England's Protestant, you're going to have some sort of toleration. The earliest ships that came to Maryland, the Ark and the Dove, which brought the Calverts, actually had a majority of Protestants on board. So that, again, was a necessity. You also had William Penn, who definitely here is a commitment of principle. Penn sets up Pennsylvania. He's a Quaker. Again, you know, self-interest. He's a Quaker. He wants a place where his people can worship. But like Roger Williams, he set up his colony to be a refuge for people of all religious sects.
So we have colonial precedents. But then you write that in the 1760s and 70s, which were the years leading up to American independence, we take another major step forward. We strengthen our commitment to religious liberty. How and why did that come about?
Well, again, back to this sort of practical necessity and just looking at history. I think by the late 18th century, Americans realized they had looked at the example of 17th century England, the wars, the conflict, and they saw that religious persecution was ultimately detrimental to the political, social, and economic welfare of a nation. And in America, where you had even more Christian groups than in England, if you adopted intolerance, this would be really adverse to the nation's prospects. And I think the colonial crisis of the 1760s and 1770s reinforced this view. I mean, it wasn't just the economic measures passed by Parliament that alarmed Americans, but the Patriot leaders also warned of the danger of the English Church, the Anglican Church, and their interference in American religious affairs. I mean, there was as much talk about the British government installing a bishop in America who would become the instrument of tyranny as there was about the Stamp Act or other offensive economic measures passed by the Parliament.
But as a result, nearly all of the state constitutions, the first state constitutions written after independence, reflected to some extent a commitment to religious liberty. Give us one example in the short time we have.
Well, you have several examples. Virginia, the Virginia Declaration of Rights, part of the Constitution of 1776, proclaimed that religion or the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence. And this sort of language was reflected in other constitutions as well.
And that's a direct tie-in, of course, to 1787. When the founders meet in Philadelphia, there's plenty of precedent for providing some provisions for free exercise of religion and separation of church and state. And as you write, it's reflected in Article 6 of the Constitution and in the First Amendment, which actually is adopted after. But tell us briefly how each of those provisions provide for religious freedom.
Article 6 of the Constitution explicitly states that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. So federal offices can't ask someone about his or her religious beliefs. The First Amendment, of course, which is going to be ratified in 1791, declared that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So those are the two key elements of the Constitution which enshrine separation of church and state and religious liberty.
Okay, but Article 6 refers to national government, and the First Amendment only restricts the Congress, not the states. So how much impact do these provisions actually have on advancing the cause of freedom of religion?
Well, I think they had an impact. I mean, at the time, you're right, the right of the states to set their own policy in regard to religion was acknowledged, and it was acknowledged implicitly in Article 1 of the Constitution, which stipulated that to be eligible to vote in elections for the United States House of Representatives, the elector, the voter, in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors or voters of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. In other words, if you were qualified to vote for the state legislature, the lower branch, you could vote on the federal election for the U.S. House of Representatives. Well, several states at the time mandated a religious test as a requirement for the franchise, and therefore, really implicitly, the Constitution approved such tests. But again, I think that the principle being established at the federal level set the tone for the country that later on the states were going to, of their own accord often, abolish religious tests, separate church and state fully. And then, of course, we're going to get into incorporation cases in which the Supreme Court mandates that the First Amendment apply to the states, and that comes later in the mid-20th century.
I want to deal with that because there's a popular misconception, go back to our idea of myth, if you wish, that we need to take on here, and that's many people. I find students, for example, in the classroom, once they've read the First Amendment and they see this as being adopted, they automatically assume at that point that there's separation of church and state at all levels and freedom of religion. But that's not the case, because still at the state level, or the First Amendment doesn't apply to the states to begin with. Is that correct?
Correct.
And how did it evolve then after that? How did we reach the point, because several states continued to have an establishment of religion, how did we eventually reach the point where we could say that we did have separation of church and state and freedom of religion, if indeed we could ever say that?
Well, again, I think the ball did get rolling at the time of the Revolution, and even though the Constitution left the states alone, I mean, there was an idea of federalism there. The real movement, the momentum, was with people on the side of separation of church and state and religious liberty, and simply the states throughout the 19th century began to abandon religious tests. And, you know, any sort of public tax for the support of Christian ministers, which was a common thing at the time of the founding. But again, it's not until the mid-20th century that you get the Supreme Court explicitly applying the First Amendment to the states. And the case, the most famous important case there, is Everson versus Board of Education in 1947. And in that case, Justice Hugo Black, without quoting the case in toto here, basically applied the First Amendment and expounded upon what it meant, and he applied these protections in terms of religious liberty and separation of church and state to the states. And he quoted in his decision Thomas Jefferson, who of course coined the phrase in 1802, wall of separation between church and state. Now, that's not in the Constitution, but many people think it is, and Hugo Black took a lot of heat for quoting something outside the Constitution. It's just Thomas Jefferson's letter when he assumes the presidency to the Danbury Baptist congregation. Justice Rehnquist, among others, has been a critic of Justice Black for this. But really, it's around that time it's formalized by the courts that the First Amendment does apply to the states.
Okay. Now, we only have a couple minutes left, but if we go back to the phrase you used earlier that we probably want to clarify here or define, the Everson case is based on the idea of incorporation. Very briefly, how did that work?
Incorporation just means simply that the Supreme Court began to incorporate the states into the coverage, into the liberties that are protected in the Bill of Rights and then other amendments. That's simply what it means. It was a series of cases beginning in the late 19th century and extending into the 20th that did just this, the court saying this liberty, which in the Bill of Rights, whatever amendment it may be, which at the time applied just to the federal government, actually applies to the state. So it was really done by judicial fiat.
Okay, so really I don't want to oversimplify here, but what we're talking about essentially is a work in progress when we talk about freedom of religion in America.
Yes, yes. Now, one interesting note, and this is where we get to present-day issues, and I tread on dangerous territory here, but we often speak of separation of church and state and freedom of religion as going hand in hand. That's what we've been doing as we've been talking, but in fact, there's a tension sometimes between the two concepts, and I think it's become greater in modern legal thought to the point where the question becomes, when does the separation of church and state begin to infringe on religious liberty? The Supreme Court has, as I've said, has been the prime mover in widening the separation between church and state, but you can say that they have done so sometimes at the expense of religious liberty in cases where, say, school prayer has been restricted, or religious displays on public property curtailed. I mean, some may look at that and say, that's proper, that's great, this way we protect religious liberty and separation of church and state. Others may say, well, you're restricting someone's right to exercise their religious beliefs by prohibiting school prayer or putting up a Ten Commandments monument in the judicial building, as we saw in Alabama recently. Now, whether Americans have gone too far in separating church and state is a question I will leave to others.
That's the perfect transition to an entirely different show, which we don't have time to do today, but that's a great way to end it. So, thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to Dr. Stephen Klugowitz, Executive Director of Collegiate Network and the author of the Essay on Freedom of Religion for the Founders and the Constitution series. And this is Talking History. Founders in the Constitution, in their own words, includes 24 units, each dedicated to a specific founder. Our guest this week, Stephen Klugowitz, prepared the following brief introduction to Charles Carroll, champion of religious liberty.
Charles Carroll is primarily remembered today for his political leadership in Maryland during the Revolutionary era. A wealthy planter, Carroll became a major figure in the Patriot movement in 1773 when he penned the first Citizen Letters, which attacked the colonial governor's unilateral imposition of a fee as an unjust tax upon the people. A member of the Continental Congress, Carroll signed the Declaration of Independence. He also helped to write Maryland's Constitution of 1776. After independence, he served in the United States Senate and the Maryland Legislature. Carroll's role as a champion of religious liberty is less well known. Like many American Catholics at the time, he favored the separation of church and state and the free exercise of religion, at least for Christians. These principles were a logical consequence of the minority status of Catholics in Maryland and the nation. In nearly every American colony, Catholics suffered legal disabilities of some kind. Catholics in Maryland, for example, were denied the vote and the right to hold office. Carroll believed that the restrictions placed on Catholics in Maryland were motivated by a desire for power on the part of the Protestant majority. Religious belief was merely an excuse to deny political influence to men like Carroll. "Designing and selfish men," Carroll complained the year following his first Citizen Letters, "invented religious tests to exclude from posts of profit and trust their weaker or more conscientious fellow subjects, thus to secure to themselves all the emoluments of government." In his first Citizen Letters, Carroll defended his right, and by extension, the right of his co-religionists, to participate in public affairs. He successfully fought to have religious liberty for all Christians, including Catholics, guaranteed by the Maryland Constitution of 1776. In his latter years, Carroll became famous among his countrymen as the last surviving signer of the Declaration of Independence. By the time of his death in 1832, American independence was assured, but the battle for toleration in the United States for Catholics and other religious minorities was unfinished.
You've been listening to Stephen Klugowitz, Executive Director of Collegiate Network and one of the historians for the Founders and the Constitution series. This is Talking History. Finally, for our site of the week, Talking History's Fiona Beattie takes us to the home of Charles Carroll, about whom you just heard, in Annapolis, Maryland.
Number 107, Duke of Gloucester Street, Annapolis, seems an unlikely address for Charles Carroll, who, after all, signed the Declaration of Independence. And if you go there expecting to visit an ordinary house, you'll find instead a mansion of splendid proportions, over three centuries old. Home to three generations of illustrious Charles Carrolls, beginning with Charles the Settler, a Catholic who came to America in 1688 to escape English persecution, the Carroll House is now being restored. It has been the site of four archaeological excavations examining the separate worlds of the people who lived in Carroll House, including the Carroll family slaves, who numbered more than 1,000 over the years. And for you wine aficionados out there, Charles Carroll was renowned for keeping an excellent wine cellar. In 1982, excavators discovered a wine bottle seal with a Carroll family crest, revealing that Charles Carroll, the wine connoisseur, had his wine bottles specially manufactured. There is a wealth of discovery in this truly historic house. To visit Carroll House, or for more information, go to www.annapolis.org.
That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you enjoyed the program. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beattie, producer. Alex Smith is our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. For more information on founders and the Constitution in their own words, as well as a valuable collection of related materials, video clips, founding documents, and more, visit the Bill of Rights Institute website at www.billofrightsinstitute.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And finally, as always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.